First of all, it's not domestic. It's halfway around the world in the Philippines. And secondly, I'm a medical anthropologist, so you're going to get a very different perspective here. My name is Paul, and I'm the director of a new undergraduate program in public health for the University of Liverpool in Suzhou, China. And I'm also a research associate with the University of Oxford. And I have no relationships to disclose, but this was partly funded by the Department of International Development at the University of Oxford. Historically, this is about decentralization. And historically, centralization and decentralization have occurred in almost all societies in patterns and in waves. And this is true in the Philippines as well. And the Philippines, as you may know, was an American colony from the beginning of the 20th century to about World War II. There are three forms of decentralization, which you see here. What I'm going to be talking about today is actually devolution, which is the most severe, if you will, form of decentralization, which all responsibility of decision-making, finance, and management is reassigned to the local level, whilst policy is often maintained centrally and dictated top-down. And this is fairly common, though it's not that common to have devolution. These were often an outcome, which I'm going to talk about, of loans, international loans, such as from the World Bank and the International Monetary Fund. So my methods, this was part of a larger study where I was looking at healthcare integration, and I needed to contextualize the healthcare system of the Philippines. And this was done with semi-structured interviews and focus group interviews, and also looking at archives at the Department of Health of the Philippines. I used convenience and snowball samples of 1,027 informants of community members, organizers, administrators at provincial, municipal, and community, which is known as barangay, and I'll use that terminology, levels in Tagalog. And we looked at four different rural municipalities throughout the Philippines, and within each municipality, we looked at four to five barangays in each municipality. And they were equivalent in terms of socioeconomic status. And the data was analyzed with NVivo. So this is just a map of basically how decentralization occurred in various sectors. Health was one sector that was decentralized among many sectors, including education, agriculture. And this happened virtually because of Ferdinand Marcos, who you may remember, some of you, was a dictator that was in power in the Philippines. And he took out several very expensive World Bank International Monetary Fund loans. He did not have to pay them back, and there were contingencies with these loans, which were called structural adjustment programs. And in structural adjustment programs, you basically are responsible for reassigning economically how money is distributed. And usually with structural adjustment programs, and this is true in many of the austerity programs from the European loans that you're hearing about now in Greece and Italy and Portugal and Spain, what's usually part of this is that state-owned enterprises are privatized, and what was controlled centrally is decentralized. Though that doesn't really quite make economic sense when you think about that. However, Marcos was not all completely negative, even though he instilled martial law. He also started the development at local levels of rural health units. And he was actually following the Maoist model in China of addressing community health services, as Mao did with the health brigades in China. So I mentioned that decentralization is an outcome of structural adjustment programs, and this was mainly from the International Monetary Fund. And the loans that Marcos took were so extreme that there was a nickname for the Philippines as being the guinea pig of structural adjustment. And this person on the left here is Corazon Aquino, who took over from Marcos. Now, Akina was this grandmotherly type. She was known as Tita Kori, or Auntie Kori, and she really presented the counterpart to Marcos, especially after he instilled martial law. And she was responsible for repaying back these loans to the World Bank and the International Monetary Fund, and she did not want to default on them. So in order to sell to the public, basically the legitimacy of paying back these loans, she depicted it as decentralization, as something that was really positive after the horrors of the Marcos dictatorship that was centralized. Don't you want to take care of yourselves now? Don't you want that ability to not have this big centralized government? And this really was part of the community participation discourse that you saw in the 1980s and is still quite prevalent. But there's many assumptions in the community participation discourse. And one thing that I have problematized in some of my research is the idea of, first of all, an external person selecting who will be part of a program as being a representative of community participation, representative of the program. There was research that I did in Guatemala where the community actually decided which NGOs they would allow to do projects. To me, that is much more indicative of what community participation is. But also the whole idea of empowerment coming externally and someone granting you empowerment, I think we can problematize that. But there's also assumptions, not just in the community participation discourse, but the overlap with the idea of decentralization and the beneficence of decentralization. And I believe this is a very, very, very basic distillation of three assumptions that we can look at: that all local levels are equal and equitable in terms of knowledge and resources, that community participation is actually desired by these communities, and that all communities have equal leadership and organizational capabilities to carry out what has been decentralized to them, the responsibilities. So let's look at the first. All local levels are equal and equitable in terms of knowledge and resources. Well, firstly, if you know a little economics, the Gini coefficient tells you the difference in the amount of wealth within a population. So if we're looking at the state level here, we could see that the Philippines has a fairly high Gini coefficient and a fairly high inequitable distribution of wealth at the state level of analysis. And in terms of Asia and Southeast Asia, the Philippines has one of the highest Gini coefficients. But if we look, and I'm sorry if this is blurred, if we look at this map, and the Philippines is about 1,050 islands, we can see that even within main islands like Luzon, where Manila is located, that outside of central Manila, that there's great disparity in the distribution of wealth and the incidence of so-called poverty. But this is exacerbated by the state. The state gives out various amounts of money to the regions. And the regions that get the highest amounts of what's called the internal revenue allotment, or the IRA, are actually those that are the wealthiest and have the most industry and the wealthiest populations, whilst the most rural and, if you will, poorest areas actually get the lowest IRA allocated to them. And so how does this play out in terms of health? Well, one way to look at this is in terms of life expectancy. And here on the left, you can see the Philippines, and these are different regions of the Philippines. And you see that life expectancy goes from about 75 years to about 53 years. And this, you can see, is equivalent to the difference in life expectancy at the state level of many different countries. So there's marked disparity in the Philippines. And we can't really say that all local levels are equal and equitable in terms of their resources, their financial resources, but also, I didn't show this here, but in terms of their knowledge resources as well. So let's look at the second assumption. Community participation is desired by all communities. So I, in addition to interviewing community members, each community has a council called the Barangay Council. And I spoke with all the members and as a group, the Barangay Council. And so there were about 20, 25 communities that I interviewed, and there were that number of Barangay Councils. And they basically felt that they were not capable, when we're just talking about the healthcare sector being decentralized, they were not capable of providing appropriate healthcare for their community. And less than 1% of their community budgets were actually allocated towards healthcare. And you may remember the WHO figure of a minimum of 4% of the GDP at the state level should be allocated to the health budget. So if we transfer that to the community level, 1%, especially what the amount of money that we're dealing with here in many of these communities is really quite paltry. The majority of community council members believed that they did not have the adequate resources to address the healthcare needs of their community. Now, one thing that Aquino was basing this on was you don't want the state elites to control what's happening. However, in the Philippines context, at least in the communities that I went to, the local elites were much more powerful and dangerous, and they could really control whether you were working or not. So to have things decentralized in this context actually made communities more vulnerable to the power of the local elites. Barangay Council's interview did not want They did not desire to have the responsibility for providing the health for their communities. They especially did not believe that they had the knowledge resources outside of the financial resources by which to take care of this. And 82% of barangay informants, the community members, believed that the quality of their healthcare system was really decreased since devolution. So in this instance, we could question if community participation was really desired by these communities. And the last assumption, all communities have equal leadership and organizational capabilities. Well, in looking at the barangay leadership, and people are usually elected by virtue of popularity and how many friends they have who knows them, that doesn't necessarily mean they could control a budget or dictate healthcare resources. There was an inability to secure community needs through the appropriate local networks, which was essential, especially in terms of getting healthcare, both human resources and material resources, medical resources. There was an inability to communicate with all the stakeholders, an inability to coordinate projects, and if they were coordinated, there was very little follow-through. There was a lack of knowledge in terms of healthcare, as I mentioned, and there was a lack of accountability and transparency. So we could question again this last assumption of all communities really have equal leadership and organizational capabilities. So how might this play out in terms of healthcare impacts? Well, if we look at just one example here, which is the prevalence of antibiotic resistance, which is really a quite serious problem that's happening worldwide. And this is just looking at resistance to E. coli. In the last two categories here, we see the Philippines. And we see with various drugs that the Philippines has some of the highest issues of drug resistance for E. coli. Part of this can be explained by what happened from decentralization. It wasn't the only factor, but I believe it was an important factor. A physician at the municipal level stated, we give the patients antibiotics for one, sometimes 2 days, and then they have to buy the rest. If your choice is between feeding your family dinner and getting Cipro, what are you going to buy? So that really is not the case. What happened before devolution was that the Department of Health provided a minimum of 2 to 3 weeks or the full course of what was needed of whatever antibiotic was needed. DOTS is still in place for TB, so that hasn't been touched. But in terms of just antibiotics, this has been a real problem. If we give the full regimen, this was a nurse, they will take a few days and sell the rest. Again, it's a problem with finances at the local level. Most of the drugs we get have already expired. And so they're using drugs that they received before devolution, basically. The monthly budget, and this really moved me. This was a nurse. At the local level, the rural health units are run by nurse midwives. And they have 2 years of education. And they're responsible not just for treating the patients at the most primary level, but they're also responsible for the administration and getting the medical resources needed. The monthly budget comes late, and I often have to purchase what drugs I can at pharmacy and hoped to be reimbursed by the mayor. And this particular person told me the mayor was about 6 months behind. Now, if we speak to the patients, we see the same story. I can't afford to buy drugs on my own, even the generics. Either the rural health unit has to give to me or I won't have. I take what I need, and this is a real problem with drug resistance. I take what I need until I feel better and I save the rest for next time. Before devolution, we had free medicine. Now it's not, and they're usually already expired. I can't afford to take them, so I don't take them at all. I take herbs. So we can see in this very little case example of drug resistance and how devolution may have affected drug resistance and devolution in general, what I found in these communities was an inability to provide medical supplies and pharmaceuticals, an inability for the community to afford biomedicine, as well as an inability for the nurse midwives to afford the biomedicine. And this was basically controlled by mayors who, as I said, were often elites and often quite corrupt, and they controlled the budget. The overall perception of worsened local health care and the midwife administrators and municipal health officers claimed that they were really being stretched beyond their capacity. And lastly, the community councils, and this to me is the most important, did not feel they were capable for providing appropriate health care for their communities, nor did they want to do this. So in conclusion, in the context assessed, devolution of health care actually, I'm only speaking of the context assessed, exacerbated already existing health care disparities in these communities, which included disparities in income distribution, governance, and human and medical resources. Thus, decentralization can be rendered more ineffective or actually more effective, if you want to turn this around, in terms of if the needed finances, knowledge, and human resources are really acceptable. There are cases you can look in terms of decentralization, such as in Brazil, where you have areas that had decentralization that was quite positive, had quite positive incomes, next to areas that had quite negative incomes. So this isn't rocket science, it's really common sense. If you don't have the resources in order to be able to control what was devolved to you or decentralized to you, you can't really do the job that you need to do for your community. So thank you very much for your time and attention.